listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center, and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I've been looking at institutions as digital content creators for the past 11 years. When I started studying e-government and the rhetoric of e-government, it wasn't as interesting a topic. It was a lot like reading instructions on toothpaste tube or on diapers. There was interesting information there, signs of deliberation and disagreement, but one had to look pretty closely. One of the subjects of the book is the anxieties that digital file making creates. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld says, people are running around with digital cameras and taking these unbelievable photographs and passing them off against the law to the media, to our surprise when they had not even arrived in the Pentagon. I open the book with the story of the Sonic Jihad debacle in Congress. How many of you know this story? The House Select Committee on Intelligence held a rare open hearing about terrorist use of the internet. Experts from a company called SAIC were paid $7 million to find evidence of terrorist use of the internet. One of the experts was Eric Michael. The final object that they showed in their PowerPoint presentation was what they said was a terrorist video game that was being used to recruit young jihadists. It turned out that it was a fan film of the video game Battlefield 2, and that the well-paid experts did not realize that many combat video games allow you to play from the perspective of the opponent. They also did not notice that the soundtrack came from the comedy movie Team America, and the so-called jihadist radical voice was actually the voice of Trey Parker. In this hearing, Representative Jane Harman read this quotation from Gabriel Wyman about how the internet is an uncensored medium that carries stories, pictures, threats, or messages regardless of their validity or potential impact. And what I'd like to suggest is maybe the small group that was using the internet to exaggerate its importance and the threat it faces wasn't really a terrorist group, but rather the Bush administration itself. So in the Virtual Politik book, I looked at the tensions between institutional regulation and content creation, that creating government websites, YouTube channels, blogs, and using other forms of social media creates. I looked at tensions between the culture of knowledge and the culture of information and ways that those tensions manifested itself. I looked at tensions between openness and reputation and anxieties about unplanned audiences and unplanned purposes when a digital file travels from the intended recipient to an unintended recipient. There's some obvious cases like the Abu Ghraib photographs or the emails of Michael Brown during Hurricane Katrina, but one could fill an entire book with such things. And last, I look at four trends in governance. One of the things I argue is that because of this anxiety about controlling messages, there's a tendency to want to hire experts from the advertising industry to help with online communication. And I look at public diplomacy, social marketing, risk communication, and institutional branding. I also argue that actually there was a lot of awareness about digital rhetoric in the Bush administration. So for example, this is a piece of advice about creating web pages for USAID, and it says things like, avoid photos and images that showcase despair, and avoid photos of panel discussions, meetings, and conferences, especially when the focus is not on the people. And I also argue that some of these anxieties go back to the Clinton administration. So there was the 2008 election. And obviously, John McCain had a series of rhetorical disasters involving his use or misuse of social media. How many of you saw McCain Space, the appealing social network site that was supposed to really get those under 25s to mobilize for the Republican campaign? It was an unmitigated disaster that was quickly colonized by 50-year-old housewives and a range of people who were not in the intended demographic. There was also Cork Invaders, which was the McCain Facebook application, which was a sort of Space Invaders ripoff. And then there were a variety of green screen related fiascos, where the green screen footage traveled on the internet and people improved it in various ways. Obviously, the Obama campaign was incredibly successful, using existing platforms and taking advantage of the practices that people already had. And if you look at just the BarackObama.com versus JohnMcCain.com, you see how he sort of magnified his statistical advantages when it came to web traffic. The campaign was also very smart, of course, about using forms of sort of low bandwidth interactivity, using things like text messages, and instead of building complicated video games, just doing an online tax calculator, which was a very simple online application, and yet rhetorically very effective. And obviously there was a lot of third-party participation, where third parties not affiliated with the campaign used the internet to disseminate content that was not officially sanctioned, and yet might have had a certain amount of persuasive appeal. So, in looking at the Obama administration now as a digital content creator, one of the things I'm asking is how much change has really happened. So, for example, right here, this is the Bush website, forparents.gov. It's an abstinence website designed for parents, which assumes that the basic relationship between parents and the state would be that the job of parents is to police their children's sexuality. It is pretty much identical in the Obama administration to its Bush administration incarnation, although there have been some significant updates in that the conversation starters have been slightly altered. For example, one conversation starter involves, you know, a neighbor's son who is joining the military, and then they've changed it to AmeriCorps. So it's clear that they've kind of given it a little bit more, a slightly different political flavor, but still basically the same message, even though the site has been retasked. One of the areas I'm concerned about is websites for children, which sounds like it might be a relatively trivial area, but in terms of civic participation, websites for children can be incredibly important. One of the things that I worry about is that far too often our government creates games and puzzle sites with cartoon characters. And really, most children visit government websites because they're doing school reports, and they would really like information, and this is a useful opportunity to give kids information literacy skills so they have some ability to understand the statistics and documents that are available on government websites. But unfortunately, this is our happy family of mountain lions, which I thought was a pretty unusual mascot to pick for the Department of Homeland Security. I'm from Southern California. I don't associate mountain lions with the safety of my children. Instead, I think that mountain lions might think my children are kind of tasty. As you can see, they've preserved the mountain lion motif, but now they've sort of replaced them with Muppets that are sort of associated with a kind of recognizable sort of televised spectatorship model, rather than encouraging children to sort of think about governance and their participation in it. And even things like the Obama administration's focus groups that they ran in Second Life, meeting with people who had disabilities or long-term chronic illnesses. That what's interesting is that the Bush administration was actually involved in several health initiatives involving Second Life as well. So that some of the things that might seem particularly forward-thinking in terms of virtual worlds actually have a somewhat longer history. And this is actually a male CDC official who has a female avatar. This was in the Bush administration, so it's interesting that there was experimentation going on in that administration. So in terms of testing the policy limits in the Obama administration, Berkman Center people have had a big role in getting government webmasters to think critically about how they're disseminating rhetorical content to the public. A case in point, this is whitehouse.gov, right? This is the old whitehouse.gov. This was the whitehouse.gov shortly after the inauguration, the second in which Barack Obama became president. But as Chris Segoyan of the Berkman Center has pointed out, the use of YouTube by whitehouse.gov created certain problems in terms of how articulated the privacy policy was to the public and how aware they were about some of the cookies that they could be picking up on their way to a government website. Of course, they've experimented with different kinds of players since then. They've also tried to be a little bit more explicit about the privacy policies on the site, so that there are ways that this case is a sign of a kind of responsiveness to those privacy concerns. There's also a sort of attempt to, when using social media platforms that are not on .gov domains, there's more sort of signaling to when you're leaving a .gov domain, and this is a very kind of elaborate disclaimer. One of the questions I would have is, how much does disclaimer language really reflect the input of the public and processes of deliberation about that which is in the public domain and understood to be part of our sort of shared virtual real estate? So there's sort of elaborate disclaimers in which they're separating themselves from endorsing any of the products or advertisements that one might see. And there are also concerns about other ways that email addresses might be continuing to be harvested as people interact with certain government domains. So for example, if you went to change.gov and you decided to apply for a job at change.gov, I'm fascinated with online forums. I think they're intensely rhetorical, and always like to look at pull-down menus on government websites. So I, of course, went through the whole process of that. And gee, I suddenly got a lot of emails from the Biden transition team, not all of which were related to an effort to gain employment from said group. So how much change, how much privacy, how much responsiveness? So this is the State Department blog, the very unfortunately named DipNote. It's actually a holdover from the Bush administration. If you look, you can find a parody of it online that I made called DopeNote, which sort of repurposes some of the original verbiage on the DipNote site. The new public diplomacy people at the State Department have expanded DipNote to use Twitter as well as the main blog at DipNote. And so they've been trying to kind of salvage a blog that really had little readership and not much interest from the general public. However, there were problems that came up with that that expansion onto Twitter. So this is the DipNote Twitter site. And Rebecca McKinnon was also Twittering, and she said, I'm under house arrest because Hillary Clinton came. She's quoting another Chinese blogger, And then she addresses this concern to DipNote. Now, what's remarkable is very soon afterwards, DipNote addresses her directly and the Chinese blogger and says, we're looking into it. So this is very fast response, clearly a sense that McKinnon is an important policy figure, that she has the ability to publicize a problem quickly, and that they were sort of in damage control mode. But what's strange is shortly afterwards, DipNote actually removed the tweet that was addressed to McKinnon that said, we're looking into it. They took it off their feed so that it was no longer on their page. And in fact, McKinnon notices that, right? She says, for the record, Dipnote wrote 9 hours ago, we're looking into it. And then she actually asks, I noticed that your response has been removed from Twitter. Know why? So obviously someone who was not strictly speaking authorized to say we're looking into it said we're looking into it. And then someone else said that really shouldn't be on Twitter. That should be removed. But while McKinnon was poking around in the social media offerings of the State Department, she noticed that photographs of Hillary Clinton's tour of China, which should technically speaking be part of the public record, had copyright, all rights reserved, put on the images in Flickr. So she raised that concern. Have you guys considered putting your Flickr pics under a Creative Commons license so the public can use them with attribution? And what's interesting now is you notice that they are, in fact, have Creative Commons licenses on them now. Right, so they're asking for the attribution, and they're asking for the equivalent work, not doing derivative works, of the State Department images. But it's interesting that we have sort of these two cases of very rapid response to concerns raised by digital rights advocates who are worried about the way that social media is being used by the new administration. But I'd argue that there's some continuing concerns where we have to sort of ask how much respect is really getting paid to remix culture, particularly when as many people have pointed out, all of the campaigns violated rules about reproducing digital materials. Right? They liberally posted copies that they did not own the copyright to on their YouTube channels. But if you look at change.gov, what you notice is there's a sort of an interesting split where there's both the kind of affirmation of the Creative Commons license. Users are informed that except where otherwise noted, content on the site is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. And then it says content includes all materials posted by the Obama-Biden transition projects. But you notice there's also a DMCA notice, right next to each other. So there's a kind of, that we can sort of see the kind of manifestation of that conflict between the desire for acknowledging materials in the public domain and a culture of sharing, and yet there's also the transition team is reminding visitors to the site that they will honor takedown notices. And if you read the fine print of that, you can see that they talk about their sole discretion, and they have the right to limit access to the website or terminate accounts of users. So you'll see a lot of the sort of same verbiage involving a .gov domain that you might see on a third-party commercial site. Obviously, one of the advantages of hosting material on third-party commercial sites is that the government then doesn't have to handle possible takedown issues. So not only is there a financial incentive to use commercial sites because they don't cost as much to maintain the servers, but you also don't have to deal with the DMCA issues. So there's a potential threat to the idea of the public record being stored in .gov domains. And I think that sort of raises the question of kind of how much permanence when you're looking at things like the inauguration page on Flickr. And that kind of raises the issue of what Siva Vaidyanathan has called the Googleization of government, the ways that third-party commercial corporations that use proprietary software, like Google, have an increasingly important role hosting materials that might conventionally be seen as part of the public record. So, for example, this is from the State Department website. This is a Google map of Hillary Clinton's travels. I'm also interested in the question about where official user-generated content is going. So, for example, if you look at recovery.gov, there are text window is for you to share your story. And this is encouraged for people to sort of share their change experiences, share their recovery experiences, sort of be part of a participatory culture. But the question of kind of how those comments are going to be archived, how they're going to be displayed to the public, which ones are going to be displayed and which ones are not going to be displayed, that's not as clear. So there's a solicitation for people to offer up images and stories and videos, and yet it's not entirely clear. They say that 6 months from now, they should have, that they will start posting that material to the public, but it's not entirely clear, at least to me, in what form that will take. So that's just a sort of general overview of some of the possible issues involving the Obama administration, sort of based on some of the ideas that this book about the Bush administration has put forward. Things are very new, things have changed really rapidly, so this is just kind of a sort of conversation starter rather than necessarily a kind of definitive research project. So thank you very much, and I look forward to, I should be on time, so let's hear some questions and comments. Yes. But if you're a historian of political discourse, this is a disaster for you in terms of being able to archive and aggregate all those comments, which is, I think one of the concerns that many people who are historians or rhetoricians like me are expressing right now is if you look at your Facebook user agreement, doing research on government comments and how citizens understand their electronic participation with whitehouse.gov is not one of the things that you're allowed to do. And in fact, Facebook researchers have gotten in trouble for trying to gather information. And of course, this is an evolving thing involving university IRBs arguing over how internet researchers should proceed in areas that are essentially, may have elements of the walled garden to them.
If you were running the whitehouse.gov, and in particular the blog area, what would you do about comments? How would you handle that? Just turn them on or moderate them, or what should they do?
I mean, the problem is I would prefer to see moderated comments on a .gov site rather than on a third-party commercial site. That's what I would like to see. However, in terms of government resources, I mean, I'm also an employee of the University of California, and I'm sensitive to the fact that there are limited public resources. And perhaps, for example, things like digitizing the congressional serial set or making sure that that the transcripts of congressional hearings are digitized might be in terms of where we should be spending our money digitally. I'm more concerned with the fact that public records, archivists aren't able to keep up with all the material that's being generated just by our lawmakers right now.
So your critique of this, or your potential concern with archiving these records for historical purposes, presumes that this is some kind of change in what's been going on, and it strikes me that the difference between having comments and discussion on a .gov site versus on Facebook is that the administration is making a concerted effort to reach out into civic society, and we can debate what that might mean. But it used, that kind of conversation, the kind of back and forth that happens on Facebook and elsewhere, is the kind of conversation that previously would have been happening in coffee shops, would not have been part of the public record. This is not a formal notice and comment kind of process or any kind of official government participation. It's a different level of participation, and I'm wondering how to analyze that, because it used to be that, you used to have pretty sharp lines between what is government and what is not government, and here you have an administration that's very affirmatively trying to reach out into civic society beyond what government used to do, and you could say that that's a good or bad thing, but if that's the goal, then shouldn't civic society, in a sense, be left out of the public record? It never was, in a sense, part of that kind of, like, the kind of public record that laws regulate as opposed to, you know, trying to archive for other purposes as you might if you were able to keep notes at your local civic meetings or neighborhood association meetings.
Yeah, I mean, but it, under those circumstances, you are able to generate records and publish them, as long as it's understood to be a public meeting at which a lawmaker is speaking. And if we have responses to comments, as I think you were indicating, it seems like those responses are significant too. I wouldn't say it's a good thing or a bad thing. I would say it's a complicated thing. And if I would argue that government media making is always going to involve tensions about how public is public and how regulated is regulated. And so I'm raising questions. I'm not necessarily, I think that these are areas that should be of concern for social media policymakers. Not necessarily making a kind of moralistic judgment. And then Judith?
So, recently I've been strongly persuaded by an argument made by a friend of ours at the new research center at Princeton called the Center for IT Policy. And they put out a paper called Government Data in the Invisible Hand, where their essential argument is the government should first and foremost be responsible for publishing its data in a machine-readable format. Mm-hmm. And only after they have reliably done so should they think about doing any kind of additional presentation or services on top of that data. And your dilemmas that you're raising with maintaining an archive of this additional activity sort of make that picture of what is the government data more complicated. Is it, you know, does it include a back and forth between government and citizens? What persuades me in their direction is that I don't think the government does a tremendously great job of building websites or internet services. And if they can start with just getting the sort of core public record out there in an easily readable fashion and let others innovate on top of it, maybe we'll have better stuff. The government is not going to build Twitter. They're not going to build Facebook. They're not going to build whatever. But on the other hand, maybe we need to define the public record more expansively as you're describing it. I don't know how to solve those. Those goals seem to be at odds with each other. You know, if we had an option to have a perfectly archived, really crappy Twitter that nobody used, would we want that instead of, you know, something where exciting stuff happens, but we have some of these dilemmas around how to keep track of it? I don't know exactly how to resolve that, but it does seem to go to some of what Gene was talking about sort of the blurring or, you know, the questionable line between what is government and what is government data and what's happening in civil society. I'm curious whether or not you think sort of fundamentally the best approach is bring more of that production sort of in-house at the government, or is it sort of push policy and obligations further out into civil society?
Well, I mean, my general answer, which is sort of my pundit's answer, is that far too often people express concerns about the most private things being made public. And I would tend to argue that in many cases, things are not public enough. And so I tend to want to kind of push the envelope toward the public. And, you know, talking to, you know, when I was working on this project for the Washington Post about how the inauguration was going to be archived in terms of social media production. And I was talking to people at the Library of Congress and the National Archives, and they're just like going, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. We are not collecting this stuff. We're just assuming that archive.org will be doing it. And I talked to archive.org, and they had this plan for, I guess, having people pull information off people's cameras and, because I'm interested in political crowds, which is part of why this is called, you know, from the crowd to the cloud. I would argue that if you look at archival materials, crowds have been important for a long time in terms of having a sense of political discourse. They're rhetorically important. That it's not just about the speaker on the podium, it's also about the crowd's participation. And that's, you know, that's, that goes all the way back to, you know, people looking at Lincoln's inauguration and creating stereoscopic images that they, you know, annotated and then, you know, gave to relatives back home. We have some of these images in the Library of Congress. So, you know, my tendency would be, let's try to think about harvesting some of that discourse that's going on in the crowd. And my fear is that, unlike, say, family albums or scrapbooks, the pictures of the Obama motorcade that you post on Facebook are entirely, they're much more vulnerable than those paper artifacts. And things like user agreements, you know, so you post a picture, the example I give is you post a picture of your breastfeeding baby, and maybe, you know, you lose your, you know, pictures of you shaking hands with Obama. You know, those things can, violation of a user agreement can create a problem for archival materials. So.
Yeah, actually, it's these two questions that came before, they are very perfect to kind of give the link what I was trying here. It's a question. So, for example, you see the administration using different tools with specific purposes, or you see the administration use different tools with, like, all possible broad purposes that one of the tools they have. Why I'm saying that? For example, in Brazil, a lot of organs from the administration, they are using Twitter in a way to communicate what is happening. So it's to enforce transparency much more, for example, when you have public grants available. But when you see what Jean, what the guys comment, it seems much more that they are doing a lot of experimentation without this concern of having a backbone, like a full stable archive behind it and applications on the top of it. So do you think that this broad experimentation is taking us to a step that we don't know what's going to happen? Or have you talked to someone in the government to see, oh no, we are under a plan using this in this way? Or, like, they are...
Based on my conversations with people at the National Archive, they are archiving some material that's on third-party commercial sites, but not all of it.
Like, the purpose they give to each tool.
Right.
Because a blog or a Twitter or the Twitter or anything else, they may have multiple purposes. But they may also have one purpose, depending. Ah, it's unilateral communication, or it's like a two ways communication. So, do you feel this, or do you just see experimentation?
No, I think that they're trying to reach. So, for example, you look at something like, say, the TSA blog, which is interesting because it's a holdover from the Bush administration. Unlike something like the White House blog, which has a very neutral tone, very impersonal tone, very kind of press releasey tone. The TSA blog that tries to have a kind of folksiness to it, and it's supposed to be written by just regular old TSA employees who are, you know, sharing their experiences with the public. So that, I mean, these media experiments, A, have histories, sometimes with the previous administration, sometimes with the people who are they're following models from other governments. So, for example, how the State Department uses Twitter has been informed to some degree by how the what are the initials, FCUK, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office of the United Kingdom, the British Foreign Service, has actually been using social media, I would say, much more than our own State Department, and experimenting more with things like, they were using Twitter on the global warming issue to try to put pressure essentially on the US by bringing activists into, by addressing activists as they were Twittering about negotiations on climate change. And this was under the Bush administration, when the sort of British government was actually doing much more with social media and with experimenting with these kinds of real-time interventions. So I think that sometimes what our government chooses to do is influenced by a lot of different kinds of models and a lot of different kinds of histories, and it's not just targeting the right message to the right audience. And I'd argue that sometimes what they do is they repurpose the same message for different kinds of social computing platforms, sometimes without kind of the right kinds of signals for that, what's rhetorically appropriate for that particular. So they'll have the same kind of impersonal press release on a variety of social media sites.
So you think that until now the experiences were much more related to transparency or participation or allowing participation? I think.
Well, I actually would give the Obama administration lower marks on transparency in terms of things like data representation. I think that if you're looking at materials about, say, the financial meltdown, that site that's supposed to be very transparent in terms of the state of the banks that are getting TARP monies, and you're kind of opening up these PDF files with, you know, charts on them, they aren't great at information representation of really complex budgetary questions. In some ways, well, in that case, I think it's much harder. What it could be. There have been some interesting experiments. For example, the French government created a national budget balancing video game to try to get the public to understand some of the kind of trade-offs in terms of how funding works and the ways that you have to sort of choose between different interests, competing stakeholders.
It strikes me there are some very interesting questions around the whole issue of archiving and data mining social media, because social media is still relatively new, but we're already starting to discover tensions between things that people express in social media like Facebook or blog comments, which they probably initially put up with the expectation that the comments were only going to be seen by their friends. And so Kevin Werbach gave an example at a panel down in Washington a couple of weeks ago about one of the questions that he asked his students about, if you put on your wall that you smoke pot, and then 5 years later, you go apply for a job somewhere, and the recruiter has Googled you and found out that you smoke pot. Is that okay? Are you worried about that?
Well, in terms of teaching my own students at UC Irvine, I mean, I teach a course on digital rhetoric, which is for graduating seniors, and it addresses those issues about public rhetoric very directly. I actually had a student in the course whose boyfriend wanted to join the Orange County Sheriff's Department, and he was sat down at a computer. And he was told to open his Facebook profile. And not only did they look at his Facebook pages, but they also looked at all the pages of all of his friends. So they were concerned about getting at least, you know, two handshakes away in terms of, you know, what's going on those sites. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting expansion of how we're, you know, thinking about what qualifies someone to be part of law enforcement. Traditionally speaking, police officers, you know, people in their social circles were called and they asked questions about, you know, does the person use drugs? Is the person a racist? You know, things that one would want addressed.
So the larger question here is that with social media, we've kind of shifted the line between public life and private life. And social media kind of play on this desire that people have to act out, to get attention, to be public, to get their 15 minutes of fame 10 nanoseconds at a time. And you know, they're especially appealing to people that maybe don't have mature judgment about how these things are going to play 20 years down the line, you know, because we don't have 20 years worth of history. And it's not, you know, parents don't sit down with their children when they're 12 years old and say, be careful what you Twitter, because it could come back to haunt you like it did Uncle Ned, you know. And so, I mean, the questions, I mean, and granted, there are certain constituencies that, you know, thrive on data mining, archives, I mean, scholars, it's obviously critical to what you do. And in my field of network research, this is an issue because we like to collect data about the kinds of traffic and messages that move around the internet so that we can understand trends and, you know, where the growth is taking place and, you know, the kinds of planning that we need to do to have adequate network capacity, you know, a year from now to support the things that people want to do. But it's hard to collect that kind of data and have it properly anonymized so that people who, you know, put stuff out with the expectation that it was only going to be viewed by their small circle of friends don't find out that their small circle of friends is now 4 billion people. And so aren't we going to have to address these kinds of issues around the maintenance of archives of information that perhaps at one point the person was happy to have public, but then later they want to retract it from the public record?
I think undoubtedly that would be an issue. I think that, you know, particularly, you know, I think government officials are already dealing with the problems involving things like email being made public. What's trickier is when they're making these kinds of participating in forms of communication that are already understood to be at least public to some degree. Shouldn't they kind of know better? So I'm sort of looking at the kind of policymaker, political stakeholder audience. Mostly, because I'm interested in digital content creators who are institutional in their affiliations. But yes, and in fact, I had a case where I had a student who, one of my assignments is you make a significant change to your Facebook page and sort of explain the rhetorical choices that you made in making that significant change. And one student decided to come out on his Facebook change and change his sexual preference on Facebook. And he got a lot of homophobic responses to that. And then what he did is he went in and he took screenshots of all, for everybody who had left a homophobic comment, he went in and took screenshots of them drinking alcohol or making racist comments or doing anything that they wouldn't want a potential employer to see. And then he posted them on his blog so that anyone Googling the names of said homophobes would also, and of course I'm, you know, as the instructor going, oh my God, this is a situation that has gotten completely out of control, because I'm also explaining to the student, well, you've just made yourself look bad to a potential employer too, because you now look like a vengeful person, even though the actions that might have been done to you initially were wrong. So these things get very complicated as far as what ends up in the public record. I always assume that everything on Facebook can be, that screenshots can be taken at any time, you know, and helpful metadata added to them to make sure to tie them to my name and the objectionable behavior that's tied to them. And I think that we need to tell that to our students as well.
I'm interested in the like spectrum of democratic participation through these networks and through the internet. And we've talked about blogging on official websites, and there's obviously direct emails with legislators and their staffs. Can you talk about any examples you've seen of participation going much further towards examples of direct democracy, seeking constituent input on a vote, that kind of next frontier of participation, and where you see that going in the short,
I mean, they still
term?
Count emails, although, you know, that's all they do, really, is it's a quantitative rather than a qualitative response to them. My concern, actually, one of the things I talk about in the book is what I call pseudo-interactivity, which is forms of chat or, you know, kind of electronic town halls that really have the appearance of deliberation, but don't actually have the substance of deliberative input. Kinds of the ways that the internet can serve political spectacles is something I'm interested in. And I think that that's something that people in the Obama administration need to be mindful of, because it's very tempting to create a more controllable form of pseudo-interactivity, which is why I kind of worry about these share your story sites. That I worry that that's a kind of pseudo-interactivity, that people are, you know, entering their stories, but that those stories are perhaps going to be selectively displayed, that stories that are critical will not necessarily, so that they have the sense of interactivity, right? They're putting something into an online forum that's going to a .gov domain, but is it really interactivity? I mean, there are other kinds of, I mean, I think one interesting case is how people are using YouTube, and they're sort of assailing their legislators, you know, sometimes in hallways, asking them tough questions, and then, you know, using little cameras to capture those responses and embarrass the lawmaker when, you know, maybe the lawmaker is trying to visit the restroom or something and is feeling a little bit impatient with said constituent. So, and then over there, how about over there first, and then try to get them for
direct. So, I'm really curious how the sort of academic scrutiny that you and some of our colleagues are putting on government use of IT changes the ability to experiment. And so as a specific pushback, let me push back on your Twitter example. I don't think the State Department reacted to Rebecca because Rebecca has a high profile. I think they reacted because they're actually being remarkably reactive in that space. My example of that would be during the Malagasy coup about a month ago. People in Madagascar who were using Twitter as the main form of information coming out of that started talking about the deposed president showing up at the U.S. Embassy and finding sanctuary there. That was a very dangerous thread to have going on. There were people reading Twitter using this as a way to plan movements in the streets that could have easily put a gang of armed men in front of the U.S. Embassy.
Sure.
U.S. Embassy jumped out in front of it within 7 minutes and got on there and was directly addressing people and saying, no, 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 I've called the U.S. Embassy. He's not in there. And got back to everybody on Twitter who had tweeted it. Most of them immediately retweeted it, a number of them then blocked it. In my opinion, it was one of the most impressive uses of government IT I've ever seen. If you get out in front of things that quickly, if you're using this material that experimentally, you're going to get it wrong. They are going to retract things. There's no doubt about it. And my guess is they wouldn't even be doing it on Twitter if they didn't have the ability to go back in their stream and sort of control it. And even if they can control it, they can't control the retweeting of it, by the way, right? So. They have less control than we think. I guess I think what I'm asking is, can we give them a little bit of a break? I mean, I understand, and I'm in the same business that you're in, and I'm trying to put as much scrutiny on this new form of rhetoric as possible. But at the same time, it also seems like all of us trying to figure out how to engage in social media are going to screw up dozens or hundreds of times before we sort of work it out. And I guess I'm wondering...
Which I would argue is all the more reason to be mindful of these tensions. And to not make them, you know, to not be cheerleaders. And certainly, I'm impressed by many of the social media efforts. But I think that this form of criticism is important to do. I mean, I don't see what you're saying. I sort of shouldn't. Also, in Rebecca's case. They chose to follow her, and they don't choose to follow everyone who follows them, right? So there is asymmetry there. I mean, so I think that it's hard to argue that her position didn't play a role in the communicative exchange. But, I mean, I'm not an Obama basher, but I'm interested in...
It's not even a question of bashing. I'm sorry, this is coming off as far more accusatory than I actually mean it. What I'm actually saying is, how do we encourage people to experiment in these spaces? We have the same problem with anyone who's in a position of authority who does this. We have the same problem in the universities. You know, when a professor decides to get on Facebook, right, it's a wonderful moment of scrutiny where we all get to see whether the professor gets it or not. And the answer is, of course the professor doesn't get it, at least initially. Very, very few of us have figured out exactly how we want to be using these tools. Most of us evolve over time. I think all I'm really saying is it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that there's going to be quite a bit of inept use of these things sort of early on and in play. And I guess one of those questions is, at what point does that pushback and the feedback actually involve people within government sort of resisting using these tools, which I think in general would be a bad outcome to come out of this?
And in some ways, I'm arguing that they're not doing enough to experiment with these tools, that it's not interactive enough, that there are not enough comments, that they're not facilitating commenting enough, that they're not using non-proprietary sites enough, that they're not... which involves experimenting and trying new things, that they're not doing enough with data representation, that they're not doing enough with experimenting with new forms of deliberation and, you know, ways to think about participation beyond the sort of traditional voting model. And how do we think about participation beyond voting, and ways that that can be formalized, and, you know, particularly when we're dealing with things that create quantitative metrics. We're used to voting and its quantitative metrics, and now we have these other kinds of participation that can be dealt with quantitatively. And do we want to just use the winner take all sort of deliberative system that we've developed for voting, or do we want to even rethink that? I mean, we have these technologies that make, you know, things like Condorcet schemes much easier to explore. So, you know, I'm not necessarily saying experimentation is bad. I might say that in some ways, for example, with the White House blog, they're too conservative.
And thinking of the way the new administration during the campaign used social media, like Twitter or Facebook, they got to be really good at using those sites for what they were meant for, you know? But were there any examples of experimentation, of them doing something new with a Twitter or a Facebook they hadn't done before? I always wondered why the campaign wasn't using Facebook to do things like poll, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, seeing that there were so many young folks on this site would easily give up a lot of information. So how much outside the box thinking was there with these established, you know, social networks during the campaign that you saw?
Well, as I sort of argued in the section about the election itself, I thought it was interesting to see that their web campaigning strategy actually was in many ways very conservative. They were using social media as people were already using it. And so I sort of second that point, that they weren't necessarily trying to develop, say, Facebook applications that would have allowed interesting forms of data mining.
I got a question about the role of the crowd in all this thing, because essentially crowd, from its very definition, consists of the people who are biased and uninformed. It consists of what the Greeks in ancient times called idiots, people that are not interested in public matters, because that was the original meaning of it. So the government is essentially about managing uncertainties, right? And the more information you get from the public, the better it is for you to manage these uncertainties. But of course, on the condition that the information is not biased, and that the information is based on, comes from informed people. So that's one thing. The other, government consists of politicians. They care about influencing people, including these idiots, right? In the meaning of what the ancient Greeks called them. What I like about this government is that it uses more persuasion. It makes you aware of being influenced than manipulation, as the previous government. And third, it also installs these transparency patterns, which are sort of a fire alarm button in case they are not managing this uncertainty as well. So what's the role of the crowd here in all these patterns? Because in every of the three dimensions, the government must rely on informed public, right?
Yeah, I mean, I tend, you know, in thinking about things like the Agora in sort of the classical world, I tend not to take as dark a view of the crowd as the kind of hoi polloi view. I think the participation of political crowds, certainly there are ways that you can create political spectacles where the crowd, you know, if you look at something like the mass games in North Korea, right, that's an example of sort of the rhetorical use of a crowd where they're essentially just a display medium. I think that's a different kind of thing than the kinds of crowd participations that I'm interested in. And, you know, I mean, someone like Howard Rheingold, I mean, I disagree with on certain things, but I think that it is true that there are these, you know, that there can be smart mobs and that there can be ways that crowds participate in public discourse and political discourse in ways that are meaningful. The other thing I'd add is in terms of how you define rhetoric. Rhetoric's not just about persuasion. It's also about taking advantage of a particular occasion. And so there can be forms of ceremonial rhetoric, right? Forensic rhetoric. You're not necessarily just talking about one kind of rhetoric. And I think one thing that's interesting about the Obama administration is how it's trying to use social media to kind of take advantage of rhetorical occasions that aren't necessarily oriented around persuasion, but that might be oriented around different kinds of civic identity that aren't just about taking getting another party to buy into a particular political opinion. So I think that, you know, as a rhetorician, this is an interesting administration to watch. I'm just sort of raising these concerns about how we're storing this deliberation, how we're displaying this deliberation, and the kinds of constraints that we're putting on this kind of deliberation.
Are Republicans inherently bad at social media?
No. No, not at all. And, you know, if you look back to who had, for example, Sam Brownback had a great website, was actually very good in terms of his appeals to constituents, and was trying to do more with getting people to do blogs and trying to get Republicans to participate, to do more kind of Web 2.0-y things pretty early on. So I wouldn't say that they're necessary, that it's that it falls easily on a partisan divide, and that there are certainly, I mean, one of the things I look at in the book, too, is about how efforts to regulate video game play, social network sites, and file sharing happens on both sides of the aisle, and so that there are anxieties about the ways that people are reusing and sharing digital files and interacting with digital platforms that, you know, some of these things pass unanimously, actually, that when it comes to regulating digital culture. So I think it's hard to say that it's sort of one side of the
other. I was just going to add that it seems to me that it's just too confounded with who's in which part.
Well, especially that's part of the question. Being a conservative, you could interpret it as being antithetical to embracing new technology and the populism of the internet.
Simpler demographic categories like age. I mean, who's more likely to adopt social media?
But that addresses a question. Then you could argue that Democrats have an inherent advantage because their constituents are more familiar with this technology and therefore more approachable,
younger.
More mobilizable.
Certainly younger.
But then if you bring in libertarians, right, because they actually have an unbelievable presence.
Oh, my gosh.
The whole deep
Ron Paul rules the internet.
Yeah, I mean, if you only read Reddit, you thought he was going to win, right? No, seriously, I mean, there was a point last year when that community was all over the internet, so.
That's a good point.
Marcos Molinas argues that that Republicans are worse at using social media because the nature of their political beliefs has them preferring top down to bottom up, whereas Democrats, do you buy that at all?
Well, I think one interesting thing, if you look at, by the way, the website of georgewbush.com is now gone. It's now reverted to the RNC. So if you put in georgewbush.com, it just forwards you to the RNC website. One of the things I found interesting about looking at official Republican Party materials compared to, say, official Democratic Party materials is how much they relied on the talk radio paradigm very, very late in the game, that they were still interested in this kind of one-to-many model that involved a kind of pseudo-participation angle, right? So that it's talk radio, so some people get to ask questions, so it seems like it has some kind of participatory dimension to it. But it's really very limited as far as how that participation is staged. And if you looked at, you know, Republican Party materials for a long time, that those talk radio links were right up on the tops of the page, right? They really were highlighted in a way that the Democratic materials just weren't engaging with the kind of broadcast media in the same sorts of ways. So I think some of it had to do with the kind of the distribution of their different media strategies across different kinds of media ties.
but there was a time when there was a small number of left-wing political blogs, and they bemoaned the fact that they had very little web presence compared to conservative and libertarian blogs around 2002-2003. And in fact, the populist element is kind of nonpartisan. I mean, there's a populist element in both political parties, and the populist element is kind of the thing that I think drives a lot of social media. And that's certainly present, you know. I mean, in it's not official Republican Party stuff, but just sort of, you know, grassroots sort of self-organizing conservative and libertarian limited government type people. And on this question about that Obama's kind of conservative in his use of some of the social media, I wonder how much of that is a reaction to the demonstrably bad effects that the Dean campaign's blog had on the success of his candidacy. I mean, there is certainly a fairly respectable belief that the Dean campaign was derailed because his people paid too much attention to the commenters on his blog and developed this delusion that they were sort of representative of voters in general. And so you had all these Rastafarian kids from Berkeley that were knocking on doors in Iowa trying to persuade farmers to come out for Dean. And it just don't fly in the real world. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I think that in terms of scholarship about the Dean campaign's use of social media, I think we're still seeing that scholarship come out now. So I think that we haven't even had a postmortem entirely of the Dean campaign.
I guess I'm puzzled by what we should be thinking about the government's role in actually running, moderating, operating social media versus facilitating it. I'm completely sold on the notion of transparency. I'm not sure how I feel about the government investing enough in social media to do it well, or the costs of not doing it well. Like I'm sympathetic to the notion of experimentation, but I don't think that totally botching it at the federal level is necessarily a good thing for anybody. And that the level of resources you have to put in to actually effectively manage a collective space, which is almost becomes a single point or multiple points within, is really what we want. Or I don't know, I haven't thought it through enough to really know where to go with that. But
yeah, I mean, I'm very, if I had to pick what's more important, I think that a good search of government materials on government websites, that might be my bigger concern. If I had to like figure out where I was gonna, if you magically put me in as the CTO and said, you know, here's, you know, $20 million, do with it what you will. I might be more concerned about, particularly since a lot of material now involving public deliberation is videotaped, and there's not enough metadata on those political processes, right? So the tape is just put up there, but how, if you're a constituent, how do you search through it to find the material that you want? Right, so that just putting a camera onto a room full of politicians doesn't necessarily create a searchable public record. So in some ways, and that might be the kind of thing that I'm interested in and curious about. And as I discuss in the book, I mean, that was something that the Bush administration just did terribly. And I actually tell the story of the Federal News Service. How many of you have heard of the Federal News Service? It's the official... it was for a long time under, beginning with Reagan, actually, an official transcription service handling Congress, the Department of Defense, a whole range of government agencies. And what was amazing is it was actually owned by the Grace News Network, which was a fundamentalist Christian organization that said its job wasn't just to bring you the news, but to change the news with the, you know, second coming. And FNS would put these copyright statements on the ends of their transcriptions, right, where they would claim ownership of the intellectual property, ownership of the transcription that that would be posted on a government website, right? So here's the public record. It's on a .gov domain, and yet we have this copyright notice affixed to, you know, the Secretary of Defense giving a public briefing or a transcript from an intelligence hearing or some of these other examples, which are, you know, so transcription, you know, not everything can be done by machines right now. So there are a lot of things that might be more important in terms of creating better search.
Would 20 million build the Google you need to do that, though?
I don't know.
But it sort of gets back to the problem. I mean, don't you need those private third-party services to provide the function that government just can't do? I mean, Google, a Haiku, whatever.
I think we need to be asking questions, though, particularly if Google's search algorithm is a, you know, a trade secret. I mean, that could matter in terms of getting to particular kinds of materials on government websites. My favorite example of bad search has to do with the White House signing statements in the previous administration, which were not clearly posted on the White House website anywhere. And I discovered that all the signing statements are the statements that the president can essentially say, oh, this doesn't apply to the executive branch, or the executive branch has interpreted this piece of legislation to nullify it, right? But it doesn't risk a veto that can then be overturned. So it's a kind of dodgy legal maneuver. And I discovered that they always contained the phrase, the executive branch shall construe. So if you put shall construe into the search box for whitehouse.gov, you could get all of the signing statements very easily. But you have to kind of know that's the legal formula that you're using in order to be able to find it. So that pretty much takes visiting whitehouse.gov every day for several years to figure out. So not something that an average person typing something into a search box would get.
You could write a program.
True, I could. But maybe. Okay. Okay.